We were just laughing about it in the studio a minute ago. It was a year and a half ago this week. It was October 27th, 2024, that we all went down to New York City to the Trump rally at Madison Square Garden. It was in the final moments of that campaign. And it was really one of the most exciting political events, even after a lifetime of going to political events, I've ever been to. It was right in the middle of Manhattan, New York City, a place that did not support Donald Trump, despite the fact he's from there. And it was, again, days before the presidential election, and it was packed. You showed up and there was a line way down the block, and then the next block, and the next block after that. And the people in the line, if you looked, weren't just from other places. They were just bridge and tunnel people coming in from Long Island to support Trump. Some of them looked like they were from Manhattan. And people were excited, really excited. And you go inside and the place is just absolutely packed. I spoke at the request of the campaign and was happy to do it. And what we were laughing about a minute ago, and something I remember very well, was a sea of placards of campaign signs in the crowd, all provided by the campaign, that said, quote, mass deportations now. Mass deportations now. I remember thinking, well, that's kind of heavy. I don't think I've ever heard any candidate say mass deportations. That's kind of forbidden to talk like that. Mass deportations? But the Trump campaign was saying it without apology. And there was something thrilling about that because, on the other hand, why not? When you live in a country with more laws than anyone can keep track of, when you live in a constant state of mild anxiety that you might transgress, break one of these laws, and be held to account for it, when you live in a country that put Martha Stewart in jail for 6 months for insider trading and a lot of other people away for a lot longer than that for crimes that no one could even really understand or explain, in some cases, the people committing them didn't know they were committing them. That's real. If you live in a country like that, why shouldn't foreigners who break your law at very least be asked to leave? Is that crazy? And if they're not asked to leave, then why are you obeying the law? Why should you living in fear of violating the tax code or some SEC reg or some wetlands regulation that's never been voted on, but that you can be severely punished for breaking? Filling in a vernal pool in your backyard without knowing it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If foreigners don't have to follow our laws, why are we paying our taxes? That's real. And by the way, shouldn't the people who live in a country, who are born in that country, get to decide who else lives in the country? Isn't it up to the population who comes and whether or not they want to be replaced by new people? Maybe they do. Okay. In a democratic republic, it's their right. But if they don't want to be, if they want to keep the population pretty much the same, they don't want any radical change, and that is the view of most people, why can't they have that? And if they're not getting it, if you have a rogue presidential administration that spends 4 years just inviting the rest of the world to come to the United States and live off public funds, use public schools and drive on public roads and use the emergency rooms for healthcare, thereby destroying hospitals across the country, making it impossible for poor Americans who want to get their healthcare in emergency rooms to do so. Why is it crazy to make them leave and come and apply legally if they want to move here and then turn them down if you want to? Because again, it's your country. It's up to you who lives here. None of that is crazy. And so as you looked out, or as I looked out from the stage at Madison Square Garden on this sea of placards saying mass deportations now, it was kind of titillating, but it was also kind of thrilling because it wasn't just about deporting people, some of whom are probably very nice people, doubtless very nice people, don't want to be deported, of course, understand that. But their desire not to be deported has to, in a republic, be balanced against and given less weight than the population's right to decide who else gets to live here. I mean, that's very basic. In fact, it's the most basic thing. If you don't have that, you don't have representative government. And so to see those signs was a reminder that actually maybe there is a political solution to this problem. Maybe we can vote our way, if not out of this, at least to a slightly better place, that we can exert some authority as voters. The people in charge can allow us to influence the course of events in our country. Isn't that the way the system is supposed to work? It was pretty exciting the possibility that could be real. But immigration was not the only topic that day. I remember very vividly standing backstage with a bunch of the other speakers and listening to people as they stood up, and a lot of them talked about Israel and America's steadfast bedrock commitment to the security of Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East, our ally in the region, historic ties. Defending Israel is defending the West, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And personally, I didn't think that much about it. For maybe the past 10 years, maybe even longer, maybe since the Bush administration, public declarations of love for Israel are kind of a stock feature at Republican political events because the Republican Party is for Israel. And that's okay. It's okay to be for Israel. I never really thought too much about it, Israel not being really at the center of my thinking about anything most of the time. So it didn't occur to me that a party publicly committed above all to the defense of Israel would be incapable or unwilling to defend itself. Never occurred to me. Seemed like you could do both. Okay, we like Israel. That's great. Doesn't mean we can't make life better here for Americans, does it? Doesn't mean we can't act in our own interest too, even as we're acting in the interest of this other country. Because there are some highly enthusiastic proponents of that other country in positions of authority in the Republican Party. That's okay. We can all coexist. We'll support Israel, whatever that means, as long as it doesn't mean like going to war with Iran in a regime change effort that's going to cause global famine, destroy global energy markets, make America poorer, wreck the U.S. dollar, cause hyperinflation. As long as we don't do that, totally fine. Want to support Israel. Great. You're into that. I'm into model trains. Next guy's into golf. We all have our obsessions. Yours is Israel. It's okay. But they're not mutually exclusive. But it turns out they may be mutually exclusive. It turns out that maybe Jesus was right. You can't serve two masters. You can only have one, because you will always wind up loving one and hating the other. Maybe that's not just a theological concept. It's a hard and true fact of human nature. You can only have one core loyalty. And to all others, you will have not just indifference, but maybe contempt. And that's becoming very, very obvious a year and a half after that Madison Square Garden rally, where not only have we not witnessed mass deportations or the completion of the wall or even the substantial construction of the wall, we've witnessed a continuation of hundreds of thousands of H-1B visa workers coming here, mostly from India, 70% from India, mostly into tech jobs. At exactly the moment when the same people advocating for those H-1B visas are warning us, that entire sectors of our economy are about to go away thanks to AI. That this is really the last moment that your kid with a degree in computer science or programming is be able to find a job. Because they are now telling us, as of today, that 50% at least, maybe more, of all American jobs will be affected, maybe eliminated, by AI in the next 2 or 3 years. So this is now. So why would you advocate for foreigners to come in and take jobs in a sector that's about to be radically reduced in size? In other words, there are fewer jobs, but you're giving hundreds of thousands of them to foreign nationals? Why would you do that? Why would you have any immigration at all into a country that's about to lose 50% of its high-paying jobs? Why would you do that? You certainly wouldn't do that if you love that country. In fact, that's the last thing you would do. If you were in charge of a country and you sincerely believe that 50% of white-collar jobs were going to disappear or change in some unspecified way, meaning begin to disappear, how many people would you import into your labor market? Well, zero. Not one. Not a single one. You would want a much tighter labor market because the value of labor is about to plummet. And that means that millions of Americans will be left with not enough or nothing at all to do. And that will be terrible for them because people without work are volatile, unhappy people. They're people without a purpose. And that will mean disaster potentially for your country because unemployed people in large numbers are dangerous. And that's why the last time this happened, the president of the United States at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whatever his faults, many, manifold, decided to mobilize unemployed men in the Civilian Conservation Corps in the largest peacetime mobilization in world history. And you know who led that mobilization? General Douglas MacArthur, later famous for many other reasons in the Philippines and in Japan. He put a general in charge of putting America's unemployed men to work. Then in the course of that work, they basically rebuilt the national parks and built the GW Parkway through downtown DC and actually did a lot of pretty amazing work to the country's infrastructure, much of which still stands. So he both avoided domestic unrest, maybe even a revolution, and he improved the country in the process. It's not an endorsement of all of his policies. In some ways, a truly horrible president. Got us into World War II for no obvious reason, et cetera, et cetera. But in this one way, the Roosevelt administration took very seriously the problem of having lots of unemployed people. What are our leaders doing about AI right now? Well, they're trying to profit from it. Of course, they're trying to make a lot of money from it, their friends and family and themselves. It was the last big boom time before the casino shuts down. That's the first thing they're doing. The second thing they're doing is scaring the crap out of the rest of us about the effects of it. Not even making any effort at all to sell it as a positive good for the average person. AI is coming. It's going to be difficult, but trust me, it's going to be awesome because here's why. There's almost none of that. There's almost no effort to reassure you that the largest technological change in our lifetimes will be in any way a win for you. In fact, they're telling you right to your face, it's going to be a disaster. What is that? Why are they telling you that? To prepare you? How do you prepare for that? Your job goes away? What happens next? There's no hint. It's going to be tough. Yeah, you think? If this all comes true, it's going to be very, very tough. So why are they telling you? And in addition to telling you, they're also continuing to import people to compete for a rapidly shrinking number of jobs. Well, that's just a middle finger in your face. That's a humiliation exercise. That's the opposite of trying to comfort you. That's trying to stoke your anxiety. That's trying to make you feel worthless. That's revealing how they really feel about you. That's answering the central question of our moment, which is, are we A, ruled by people who are selfish and short-sighted, incapable of longitudinal thought, totally unwise, greedy? Is that the leadership class we have? Or is it even worse than that? Are we ruled by an elite that actually hates us and hates the West and is doing whatever it can to harm the population of the United States and the West and of Europe and of Canada and Australia, New Zealand, the West? Are the people in charge actively angry at us? Do they not like us at all? Do they mean us harm? You don't want to think that. That's so dark. Could that really be true? Hard to imagine it. Your average American, used to living in a very nice country, very nice people, a country where people are so nice that people who aren't nice, people with dark motives, really go out of their way to hide those motives, to dress them up as, I don't know what, charity, to build a NGO around whatever plans they have. No, really, we're helping you here. Americans are not used to imagining that the people in charge have not simply no interest in them, but actively desire to harm them. And the first time most people in this country even entertained the possibility of something so grotesque was during COVID, when it became really clear that the COVID shots not only weren't safe, they weren't effective. There was no possible upside to this whatsoever. And then the downsides became, well, too obvious to ignore. People started dying. Kids started having heart attacks. Women stopped having babies in the numbers they were having before. It was causing infertility, obviously. People you know started getting pancreatic cancer, something that was so rare 30 years ago. It was the kind of thing you'd heard about once in a while. Pancreatic cancer, yeah, there's no fixing that one. That's the worst cancer you have. It's incredibly painful and it's not curable. All of a sudden, you know 10 people with pancreatic cancer. What's that? Maybe it's not connected to the COVID shots. We wouldn't know because no one's tried to figure it out. So vanishingly small is the interest from our ruling class in finding out the effects of the COVID vax given to tens of millions of people that we still don't know. Our vast public health infrastructure has not been mobilized to find out what the effects of the biggest inoculation campaign in global history were. We still can't say, but it's obvious they weren't positive. So if you wind up killing a lot of people, which the COVID vax did, and then you refuse to find out where the virus came from in the first place, and then you pretend that nothing bad happened, it's kind of hard not to suspect that maybe you want to hurt me. You don't want to think that, but what's the other answer? But it's on the question of immigration, and not just immigration, on this eve of technological revolution, on the eve of AI, that it becomes very, very clear that the same people who pushed us into a regime change war with Iran, a war that will by definition cause famine, even now, if it stopped today, people would starve around the world. It's a math question. It has to do with energy and fertilizer. And this will cause hunger and starvation, mostly in Africa, but not just. Those same people are also the ones, literally the same people, who are pushing the United States to continue to allow the rest of the world to move here. And once again, there is no justification for this on practical grounds. Zero. And you know that because no one's even trying to make the case. It used to be when people stood up and said, we need more immigration, they at least paid you the compliment of explaining that our industries, our factories need this. Who's going to pick the grapes? Our farms need this. Low-wage immigrant labor makes the bounty possible. That's the case they made for generations, more than 100 years. And in some cases, they were right. It's true. The United States did get a lot out of the consumer in the United States, did get a lot out of low-wage immigrant labor. Fact. There were also downsides. But the economic case at least was coherent. Short-term, it was coherent. You never hear that anymore because it's not true. Most agriculture is automated. Tech jobs are going away. Law firms are going to start laying off people. Meta, which you'd think would be immune from all of this because it's got a pretty great business model based on spying on you and selling your preferences to advertisers. Meta laid off 8,000 people the other day, thanks to AI. So this is coming for everyone. So at that moment, to advocate for more low-wage, low-skill immigration into the United States, which I think we can say conclusively, despite the virtue or lack of thereof among the specific immigrants, I think we can say is a net cost to the United States. There's really no debate about that at this point. Anyone advocating for that is aggressively opposed to the interests of the population. That's shocking, but it's happening. And it's the same people who pushed for the war with Iran specifically. So 2 weeks ago, there was a vote in the House of Representatives about whether to extend temporary protective status, TPS, to hundreds of thousands of Haitians who have been living here for quite some time. They came here illegally. They were granted protection for reasons that aren't exactly clear. It's not obvious why the United States owes the people of Haiti a debt. The United States has not made Haiti better, but not for lack of spending money on Haiti. Haiti's problems are resistant to our interventions. I think we can say that. For whatever reason, but the United States has been intervening in Haiti for over 100 years. It hasn't gotten better. So hundreds of thousands of Haitians came here illegally. They were granted this temporary legal status, and the House of Representatives had to vote on whether to re-up it or not. And they just did. And 10 Republicans voted with all Democrats to extend the protection, which is now extended. And they'll tell you they're not taking any welfare benefits, but of course, like all poor people who move here, they are fundamentally dependent on public services. Of course, particularly healthcare, at a moment when the average birthright American is wondering, how do I pay my health insurance premiums? Or just has foregone them completely, doesn't have health insurance. Many people in this country, millions of people have decided, I can't afford health insurance. Is that the moment that you want to turn our public health resources, our emergency rooms over to foreigners? It's just the opposite. That is an act of aggression against Americans. Well, who voted for it? Of the 10 Republicans who voted to extend temporary protection another 18 months, all neocons. In fact, the most fervent supporters of the state of Israel in the House of Representatives, almost to a person, are the same people who voted for this. And they would include Mike Lawler of New York, the sponsor of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act or something to that effect, a censorship bill. Criticism of Israel should be illegal. That's the thrust, always. He's one of the people who voted for this. Congressman Don Bacon. Congressman Don Bacon of Omaha, Nebraska. Second district. In fact, it's Warren Buffett's dad's seat. Don Bacon, Air Force General, one of the most florid, red in the face neocons in the Congress. Nicole Meliotakis, also of New York. Congressman Salazar from Florida. These are Israel's most loyal soldiers in the United States Congress, and they are voting to open our borders once again. So it's yet more evidence, and that evidence has been mounting for many years, as we're going to show you in a minute, that there is a direct connection between loyalty to a foreign power and a desire to hurt this country. You cannot be loyal to two masters at once. You will love one and hate the other, to restate. And again, that's not just a Bible verse. It's the daily lived reality of every human being. You can have but one true loyalty and you will hate the rest. And they clearly do. And we've known this for a while. So here's now semi-famous, not famous enough, videotape of a man called Bill Kristol speaking at an AEI event. AEI is a neoconservative think tank in Washington, the American Enterprise Institute. And Bill Kristol was for many, many years the most famous and most influential neoconservative voice in Washington, D.C., and hence the country. He's one of the founders of the Project for the New American Century, which laid out why, in about 1997, 98, why we needed to go to war with Iraq. This was before the pretext of 9/11 was introduced, before they told us that actually Saddam was behind 9/11. This was just a blueprint for how the United States military needs to knock off, needs to regime change Israel's opponents in the region to give Israel regional hegemony. And now a lot of us who watched this happen, in fact, I worked about 10 feet away from where that document was formulated, didn't pay a lot of attention. It didn't seem, first of all, likely to happen. Are we really going to invade Iraq? Kill Gaddafi? Overturn the Assad regime in Syria? I mean, it's so far away. Are we really going to do that? We've got problems here. I don't think it's actually going to happen, number one. And number two, that's just a different realm. That's foreign policy. That's like an academic exercise. It doesn't really have much to do with life here in the United States. And in any case, the people advocating for it are doing so, and they tell us this all the time because they think it's good for the United States. This is in our interest. This is for our safety. We need to spend $1 trillion or now $1.5 trillion a year on the Pentagon so we will thrive at home, so the homeland will be safe and prosperous. That's what we call it, the Department of Homeland Security, because the first concern is the homeland, the country where we live, the country our ancestors built, the United States. That's the goal, is to protect the United States and its people, because what is the United States but its people? That's all it is. It's American citizens. And we need to help them. And admittedly, it's kind of complicated, our plan. We're gonna bring democracy to flower in the Middle East, but that will make it a lot better here. That's what they were telling us. And some of us who weren't paying enough attention or weren't wise enough to understand the difference between a truth and a lie kind of ignored it. Okay, now, Syria, Iraq, go crazy. But with the rise of Donald Trump in 2015, it became a lot clearer what was actually going on. Donald Trump, whatever his demonstrated faults, is brilliant at one thing. He is a genius, and this may be unintentional, at bringing into stark relief the differences in worldviews between people and groups. Donald Trump is a living Rorschach blot. You look at Donald Trump, what do you see? And so his purpose really for the last 10 years, maybe his most important purpose, has been to show the rest of us what the debate is really about and what the stakes really are and what the people involved in those debates actually think. Because something about Donald Trump evokes a kind of involuntary honesty in people and they just blurt out what they think. And that happened to Bill Kristol in 2017. Now, Kristol was a kind of half-hearted Trump supporter. up until the moment in early 2016 when Trump traveled to Greenville, South Carolina and engaged in a Republican candidates debate, a primary debate with Jeb Bush and the other 27 people running that year, or whatever the number was. And during that debate, he famously said to Jeb Bush, "Your brother got us into the dumbest war in history. The Iraq War was a huge mistake. Only the weapons manufacturers got anything out of that. It hurt this country, killed a lot of people, and it drained our treasury. That was a mistake." And it was at that specific moment that Trump lost the support of Bill Kristol and everyone like Bill Kristol in Washington, the neoconservative foreign policy establishment, the people who really sincerely believed, the signers of the Project for the New American Century mission statement, which would include Dick Cheney and Bob Kagan, John Bolton, all of them. All of those people decided that Trump was not simply a candidate they couldn't support. He was their enemy. And they became famously Never Trump. And that's why. That was the issue. His criticism of the Iraq War was the issue that drove them not simply away from Trump, but to the polar opposite position. Many became Democrats, including Bill Kristol. And that really should have told us something right there. Really? That's your red line? The Iraq War? Why is that so important to you? What about the opioid crisis raging here? What about the fact that our industrial base is gone? Have you driven across America recently? How's it look? Midtown Manhattan, is it pretty clean? And this immigration question, why shouldn't we build a wall? We paid for Israel's wall. Why can't we have one? What's the answer? There was very little conversation about that. Why is this one issue, support for Israel, the only thing that matters to you? It's hard to know, but it clearly was. And in the case of Bill Kristol, we're grateful that it was, because he was so enraged by Trump that he began to tell the truth. And he began to say what he really thinks, not simply about Trump, not that interesting, but about the United States and its population, the people who live here, Americans, American citizens. What do you think of them, Bill Kristol? Well, here in 2017, Bill Kristol explains what he thinks of the rest of us. Watch.
Look, to be totally honest, if things are so bad, as you say, with the white working class, don't you want to get new Americans in who aren't going to be? I'm serious. You can make a case that this is going on too long and this is too crazy, probably. And I hope this thing isn't being, like, you know, videotaped or ever shown anywhere. Whatever tiny, pathetic future I have is going to be totally collapsed. You can make a case that America has been great because every I think John Adams said this at the beginning, right? Basically, if you're in a free society, a capitalist thriving society, after 2, 3, 4 generations of hard work, everyone becomes kind of decadent, lazy, spoiled, whatever. And then luckily you have these waves of people coming in from Italy and Ireland and Russia and now Mexico who really want to work hard and really want to succeed and really want their kids to live better lives than them and aren't sort of clipping coupons or hoping that they can hang on. And meanwhile, you know, grew up as spoiled kids and so forth.
It's hard to even comprehend the contempt in that statement. We're clipping coupons and kind of hanging on, lazy, decadent, spoiled. He's describing Americans. He's describing you and the people who live next to you and down the street and across the country. He's describing people whose ancestors built this nation. And he's given up on them and he hates them. And he doesn't have the self-control prevent himself from saying so out loud, which he just did, clipping coupons. Now, think of it this way. If you're a leader of this or any other country or any organization or any family, your duty is to the people you lead. And that duty has to be informed by love for those people. And so imagine the father of unruly kids taking the same position. My kids are hard to deal with. They're lazy. They're spoiled. They don't have any money. They're clipping coupons or whatever, just hanging on. So to a father who loves his kids, of course, the answer would be, what can I do to help? How can I make them less lazy, less entitled? How can I give them spark, drive? How can I get them on the right path? No decent father would say, these kids are way below my expectation. It's inevitable, by the way. When they get to their teen years, they're just useless. I'm getting new kids. I'm just going to adopt some new kids. Maybe they don't even speak English. I don't have to even listen to their concerns, really. Maybe they'll just be so grateful for 3 square meals, they'll do whatever I say. And my own kids, they can go die. A father with that attitude would be a monster. A leader of a country with that attitude is a monster. And that is exactly the attitude Bill Kristol revealed, maybe for the first time, in public. And it's an attitude with profound consequences. And maybe it shouldn't surprise us. Anyone who can advocate for the murder of children in Gaza, actual kids, Palestinian kids, but still kids, not political, not responsible for any crime at all because they're children. Anyone who can look at their deaths and say, no big deal, is probably not the kind of person you want in charge of anything in your country. Because that reveals hatred for other human beings. And no one who hates other human beings like that can ever have authority over you, because they'll treat you like the Palestinians at a certain point. And they are. So it shouldn't shock us. But when that video came out, it did shock the few who were paying attention. Really? I thought the neocon program was designed to help us. At least that's what you claimed. But you have hatred for us. And in the subsequent years, the 9 years since he said that, it's become incredibly obvious. Virtually every bad policy emanating from our government comes from exactly, to a person, the same members of Congress and the same members of the administration who are advocating for wars like the one we're in now. All of them are bad for the country, and they would include, and the list is very long, AI. Again, hard to see how that's good for us. Hard to see how it's a good idea to put a data center in your town. Your utilities go up, your water gets poisoned, almost nobody gets employed. How is this a win for you? Shut up, we're getting a data center. That would include our drug policy, where over 100,000 Americans still die every year of overdose. What are we doing about that? Is it even a conversation? No. That would include the more grotesque and flamboyant and cartoonish expressions of hatred toward Americans, like transgender surgeries for children. Yes, those are still going on. Because neocons in the Congress have blocked any attempt to stop them. That's a fact. You can look it up. And above all, it informs their views of immigration, which are motivated, as Bill Kristol just showed, not by what we thought they're motivated by, trying to hike GDP. They think it's good for the aggregate economy. No. They don't like the people who live here, and they would like to see them replaced. Kristol just said that, and the behavior of the rest show that that is true. And these are exactly the same people who've inspired these policies in Europe. And let's stop lying. Europe does not have autonomy. Europe is a confederation called the EU that is a vassal of the United States. We know that because there are American troops throughout Europe. Europe is under the thumb of the control of NATO, which is controlled by the United States. So what happens in Europe, whether it's energy policy or immigration policy, happens because our leaders sign off on it. So let's stop the pretense. Germany is not making its own decisions at all. The United States is making those decisions. And those decisions over the past 30 years have destroyed the population of Europe. And that's probably not an accident, nor are the coming food shortages, nor is the coming migration crisis, which is coming. When there are food shortages in sub-Saharan Africa where more than a billion people live, where are they going? Europe and the United States, to the West. That's all obvious. That's not a conspiracy theory. Watch it happen. And the people who inspired it knew it was going to happen, and it happening was part of the reason they did it in the first place. So this is just another way of letting you know that the motives here are not only impure, they're not simply disloyal, they are malicious. But watch it now from a couple of members of Congress explaining, or really failing to explain, why these are Republicans, these are MAGA members, these are very loyal soldiers in the MAGA army. Watch them explain, or again, not explain, watch them deflect questions about why they voted to extend temporary protection to Haitian illegal aliens. Here's the first up, and this is Maria Salazar of South Florida.
We have almost 100 Democrats that are willing to vote for this, okay, because look, it's impossible if we, the Republicans, put together a bill like this one on the floor for any Democrats with Hispanics. Supposedly, you know, Hispanics belong to the Democrats. Not anymore, because right now we're going to be demonstrating to the Dems that we are not such a bunch of racists, that we're giving them dignity, not citizenship.
Right.
So we're not racist. Well, who said you were racist? We're not racist. So we need to do this or else we will be perceived as racist. In fact, we will be racist. Now, that is precisely the style of argument, with air quotes, that Republicans, including Donald Trump, very famously objected to when the left employed it. Shut up, racist. It became a meme, and for good reason. Rather than respond to the argument, rather than make the affirmative case, it's a good idea for the United States to do this because that sentence never got completed. It was outrageous for you to ask questions about it and the massive, unprecedented demographic change in this country, not just in Europe, here, especially here. Because if you asked about it or demanded an answer to understand why it was happening, you were, quote, racist. Racist. Okay, now. And that is a MAGA Republican. That is a confirmed neocon, a loyal soldier for AIPAC, telling you that if you ask questions about it, you're racist. Maria Salazar, ladies and gentlemen, of the state of Florida. But here really is someone that all of us should pay a lot closer attention to. This is Congressman Don Bacon of Omaha, again, a former Air Force general. And why is it, by the way, and you hate to even notice this because it's, there's something really troubling about it, but the more time our representatives seem to have spent as military officers or intelligence officers, the more hostile they seem to be to American citizens. It's just something we've noticed. You don't want to think that, by the way, because all Americans correctly have respect for their armed services. But it is true, and anyone who's served in the Congress can verify this, that members who have been officers in the U.S. military tend to have the most anti-American views. Very, very odd. It'd be interesting to know why that is. Just noticing. In any case, here's Congressman Don Bacon asked by a reporter, hey, why'd you vote to extend this protection? Why are you doing something that's the very opposite of what Donald Trump ran on when you say you're a loyal soldier for Trump? And here's the answer that Don Bacon gave.
Hi, Congressman Bacon. You recently voted with all Democrats to extend TPS for Haitians for another 3 years. Over 90% of these Haitians entered the country illegally. And actually,
they're legal now.
Well, 60% of them are
legal. They're legal now. They work. They're not allowed on welfare unless there's unique situations like they're married to an American. And so are you part of the Know Nothing Party I was talking about in the 1850s?
No.
You represent a minority of the country that hates immigrants.
That's not true. Millions of people are just concerned about the future of this nation. They say that, and you know, aliens.
I see you're wearing a cross. You ever read the verses in the New Testament that talk about how you should treat immigrants?
Yeah, I don't think that means just opening up the country for everyone to come here.
And these people are legal. What do you don't get about that? They're legal.
Okay, well,
they're
as far
legal,
as
legal, and they're working, they're paying taxes. They're not even allowed on welfare. Unless they're married to an American or there's some out when they get out. So I just think you don't have your facts right, and you represent like a 20% core or 20% group that
I actually represent them. The majority of the MAGA base. And I mean, I think you're misaligned with the president on this, and many others are concerned about that as well.
Well, I represent the vast majority. I represent my district, and I won my district.
Okay, so as far as the amnesty bill or the Dignity Dodd bill, because it's actually titled in Spanish.
Amnesty, so you are a hardcore anti-immigrant person. Wow, but you have to, please start reading the New Testament every day. It may do you well.
You just hate immigrants. You hate immigrants. Notice the immediate identification of your motive, which always, it's always hate. Hate. Hate speech. You're motivated by hate. No, actually, I have a sincere question. What's the answer? You hate immigrants. You're a bad Christian. Maybe you should read the New Testament. Jesus calls for open borders. Really, where is that? Congressman Bacon? That would have been an interesting question to ask. Certainly, the answer would be stop hating. But what's so interesting is that rather than explain to that reporter why this is in the best interest of the United States, he says, we have to do this or else we're not Christian and we're haters. So there is a kind of religious fervor about this, this desire to change the population of the United States and to do it quickly. Now, on the left, this has been the goal for a very long time. A fairly famous picture came to light once again this week from a documentary done in the Southern Poverty Law Center. And it shows taped on the wall of the SPLC headquarters is a chart, handwritten, on the declining percentage of whites in the United States. That's the goal, of course. Why would that be the goal? Because the United States remaining majority white is for some reason terrifying, so terrifying and so upsetting that even mentioning the current demographic mix of the United States is considered a hate crime. Can't say that. Because the reality itself is considered repugnant. For some people, that is dangerous, immoral, and unacceptable, and it must be changed. And that's, of course, the purpose of this. There's no plausible economic benefit to continuing temporary protective status for hundreds of thousands of Haitians. Like, tell me how that's a win. Maybe it is. If it is, tell us how. They don't even bother. Shut up, hater. Because, of course, the true imperative is to change the complexion of the United States. And the left has been really clear about this. Joe Biden said it out loud multiple times. That's a good thing. Nancy Pelosi said exactly the same thing. But now you have the neocon wing of the Republican Party also saying that's the goal. What's so interesting is that even as they say out loud, effectively, our deepest fear is that the United States will be some kind of ethnostate with a racial majority that's white. That's a huge fear. Even as they say that, they demand that Israel remain an ethnostate. Here's a tweet, and there are many, but here's just from Don Bacon, the guy you just heard calling that poor woman anti-immigrant, a hater, a bad Christian. Here's his definition of support for Israel, and this is a tweet he sent this fall. Zionists believe the Jewish people should have a homeland called Israel as promised in the Bible. If you don't think Israel should exist as a Jewish state, then I'd say you're an anti-Semite. You're an anti-Semite if you don't think that Israel is inherently and has a moral right to be, a biblical right to be, an ethno-state, not just a state, a Jewish state. Now, a lot of us are kind of agnostic on this question. Israel wants to be an ethno-state? Fine. I mean, okay. Not my country. Not too upset about it. Feel sorry for the mistreatment, the murder of Palestinians. But a kind of core tenet of nationalism is each country gets to define its purpose and its vision for itself. And if it's not your country, it's kind of not your business as long as they're not forcing you to, say, pay for it, which they are. But let's say they weren't. And Israel wants to remain an ethnostate. Fine. It is an ethnostate. Don't know why it's embarrassing to say that. Don Bacon just said that. You're an anti-Semite if you don't want it to be a Jewish state. Okay, fine. Fair enough. Don't agree with your definition of anti-Semitism, but it's very important to Don Bacon that Israel remain an ethnostate, and very important to most members of Congress. They'll tell you this. But it's at the same time repugnant, the idea that the United States should be an ethnostate. In other words, their number one goal as a policy question is to keep Israel an ethnostate while preventing the United States from being one. What is that? Why are those goals the inverse of one another? And why are they so important? You would think a leader of our country would be completely agnostic as to the demographic makeup of Israel. Why does that matter to us exactly? What effect does that have on the United States? Why is that our concern? Again, as long as you don't have to pay for it, your weird apartheid system, or the murder of your racial opponents, we shouldn't be paying for that. But as long as we're not, how many members of Congress are standing up and saying it's really important that China remain 95% Han Chinese, or it's bad that they remain 95% Han Chinese? Members of Congress don't even know what the ethnic mix of China is. They don't care. But they know a lot about the ethnic mix of the United States and Western Europe and Canada and New Zealand and Australia, and they're very opposed to those countries remaining majority white. It's one of their main complaints about Russia, by the way. They fixed that problem in Ukraine. Because this war, which has been supported from day one by the very same neocon lobby that got us into the war with Iran, that lobby has extended this war with U.S. and now European tax dollars to the point where so many Ukrainian men have been killed that Budanov, the number two in the Ukrainian government, just the other day announced we're going to have to import Africans to live and work here because we don't have enough men. We're going to have to change the demographic mix of Ukraine for all time, for all time. We're going to do what Genghis Khan was unable to do, which is totally change the composition of who lives in Ukraine. So Ukraine as a nation, the nation that existed 5 years ago, will cease to exist, period. And its farmland will likely be bought by foreigners because that's now legal under Zelensky. So you just saw the elimination of a European country as it existed 5 years ago. And you saw that not simply because Putin rolled over the border and invaded sovereign Ukraine. You saw that because Western elites pushed that. That has been their overriding goal for the past 4.5 years. So now you're starting to understand that the goal is to allow really one ethnostate in the rest and not allow any others. Now, why would that be the goal? And the truth is, no clue. No idea. That is so weird. Doubtless there is some explanation. Maybe it's theological or spiritual. It's above my level of understanding. But just noting the behavior and the public statements of everyone involved, that's clearly the standard that they're holding this country and the rest of the world to. One ethnostate and one ethnostate only. And by the way, only one country with an inherent, quote, right to exist. And if you press them, and I have, they will admit only one country has a right to exist. We may enjoy having certain countries exist, and if they can defend themselves, they can continue to exist. But only one country possesses an inherent right to exist. And that's also the only country that has a right to be an ethnostate. No European country possesses that right. So why bring this up? Well, because there's no avoiding it. That's why. Not because it's a comfortable topic. Not because the people in charge are going to be happy to hear it. They won't be. But because you should know it, we are in a moment of profound change. Whenever you're staring down the barrel of global famine, which we are, and the end of our long-standing system of energy production and distribution, which we are, whenever there's a real possibility that someone uses nuclear weapons, which we face, despite whatever they tell you, that is real. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. It could happen. You are looking at a world that is resetting. Big things are changing, not just little national borders, but much more than that. The collapse of empires, the rise of others, maybe even more than that. So you should know the motives of the people involved. And there is no topic that reveals motives more clearly than the question of speech, which is the foundation of freedom in all countries at all times, and is the basis of our system of government. Democracy cannot work unless people are free to say what they think is true. Because how can you cast an informed vote if you don't know the facts? Well, if you're prevented from speaking honestly about what you think those facts are, of course you can't cast an informed vote and the entire system falls apart. But it's even deeper than that. You cannot tell a sovereign human being what he must say or believe. Period. Because those rights are inherent. Human beings are born with the right to say and believe what they think is true. That right was given them by God, not by government. So if you take it away, you are by definition treating people as subhuman. You are telling them you cannot speak because you don't possess those rights because I consider you a slave. So this really is the difference between freedom and slavery. So whenever you hear people say, using whatever pretext they come up with at the moment, you're not allowed to say that. You are watching an attempt by the people in charge to enslave the people they rule over. And you are, and it brings great sadness to acknowledge this, you are watching right now the people that, if you're watching this, you may have voted for, the president and the constellation of supporters around him, office holders around him, call for censorship. Now, we're going to begin explaining and showing that this is true with a clip from someone. You always kind of feel guilty playing these because it is Mark Levin, after all, who was an audience in the dozens organically, but who has been pretty reliably used as a mouthpiece for what's coming next from this administration over the past year. He is, we know this because the president has said it many times, very close to the president and fully aligned with the president, according to the president's own description. So here is Mark Levin's solution to America's greatest and most pressing problem from his perspective, which is criticism of the government of Israel. Here's what we should do about it, says Mark Levin.
The violence that is being preached on different broadcast platforms by different politicians, largely, not exclusively, largely Democrats, largely leftists, Marxist Islamists, although we have the woke Reich, R-E-I-C-H, is horrendous, and I believe is really, really adding fuel to the fire of hate out there and making it very, very difficult for a free people to even have a discussion about what they want or how they want it and so forth. And so it's not the first time things like this have happened, but it really is problematic because so much of it is protected. And you heard people say, don't you believe in the First Amendment? They don't even know what the First Amendment believes. Do you want to deplatform people? You know, the libs do that. I don't have any problem with deplatforming Nazis.
Now, it's hard to laugh at a Levin clip. It's not an attack on him, but it's just the irony is so rich. So he begins by saying that people who criticize the government of Israel are espousing violence. Now, this is coming from a guy who's literally called pretty recently on the air on Fox News for nuclear strikes against the government of Iran, who has relentlessly defended the murder of civilians by this and the Israeli government. So for this person to say that opponents of violence are actually the ones espousing violence is hilarious, but on brand. Because it's, of course, always the sin they're committing that they accuse you of being guilty of, always and everywhere. It's the perfect inversion, which is the hallmark of evil. The evil lie is never 5 degrees from the truth. It's 180 degrees from the truth. They accuse you of what they're doing, and that's how you know. It's not simply prevarication. It is a denial of the existence of truth. But in any case, you see Mark Levin saying, people who criticize the government of Israel, and that is his, and to the extent there is one, the official definition of anti-Semitism is criticism of the government of Israel, the secular government of Israel, which is not supported by all Jews, that's for sure. But no matter, criticism of a foreign government is hate, tantamount to violence, is stochastic terrorism, the left might say. And Mark Levin, the right-wing MAGA guy, is saying those people should be silenced by the tech companies. But that's not censorship, because somehow it's not. Well, that is exactly what Republicans, including Donald Trump, described as censorship when the last Democratic administration did it at scale during COVID. That is exactly what they were talking about when they said the Biden administration engages in censorship. And they were right. Telling tech companies, which are dependent on federal contracts, that they have to toe a political line is the same as banning speech, because tech companies are the conduits through speech flows. So yes, that is censorship, legally and morally. And Mark Levin, who has positions that are shared by only a tiny percentage of the American population, and this is knowable through public opinion polling, is telling you that anyone who disagrees with him must be silenced. But he's just a weekend host on Fox News. Who cares what Mark Levin says? Well, as if on cue, Mark Levin's suggestion on Fox News has now been bolstered by an actual piece of legislation sponsored by Josh Gottenheimer, the Democrat from New Jersey, and amazingly, Republican MAGA stalwart Mike Lawler, two of the most florid and least ashamed neocons in the United States Congress, introduced legislation today to compel the tech companies to ban people who criticize Israel, the government of Israel, because that's hate. And under the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, they're right. The definition that's been encoded in law in the majority of American states and in 40 countries around the world. The definition we didn't pay any attention to because it seemed too dumb and like, who cares? That definition is now the operative definition, and it means that criticizing the behavior of a foreign government is a hate crime and can get you censored in your own country. So what's the takeaway from all this? Well, the first takeaway is censorship is coming, and it will work unless people exercise their God-given and First Amendment guaranteed right to push back against it with words and do so at high volume without any shame at all. It's going to need a refusal to be intimidated by false claims of, quote, hate. And any Republican who voted for Donald Trump because he was sick of being told to shut up racist should join this chorus. No, you're not going to intimidate me into being quiet about the behavior of a foreign government that I pay for just because you call it hate. Not playing that game. Sorry, I voted against this, and I'm going to stand on principle and fight it now, no matter what. That's the first thing. But the second thing to know is that the motive here is dark. This is not how you would ever treat people you cared about. This is how you treat people you hate, people you have contempt for, who you find inconvenient, annoying, whose mere presence you find grating. You'd rather live next to Haitians under temporary protective status than next to birthright Americans who have these outmoded expectations of like a job and healthcare they can pay for in an emergency room that's not crowded with people who don't speak English. And I don't know, the right to say what they think, the right to complain about their leaders, even the right to complain about the behavior of a foreign country that they pay for. You hate people like that. And there may be other reasons you hate them, but you certainly hate them because they are a reminder of how you have failed. You have not done a good job running this country. You don't even care to try. You'd rather run the world or the empire. You don't want to improve Baltimore. You don't care about Gary, Indiana. Rural America makes you sick. As Bill Kristol said, all those coupon clippers and people just barely holding on. Normal leaders would ask themselves, why are people mad? What are they dissatisfied with? How can I help them? They're clearly in pain. They should have asked this question when Trump got elected the first time. Why would you elect an orange guy who ran casinos in Atlantic City when there are all kinds of great candidates? Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz, you had a lot to choose from, but you chose Trump? A normal, reflective person would reach the only conclusion possible, which is because they're dissatisfied with me. And maybe I need to change and serve their needs better and listen to them once in a while and not dismiss them with the back of the hand or charges of bad motives or hate or censorship. But they haven't done that. And they haven't even tried to do that. They've never looked inward once in 10 years. And now they've reached the point of maximum frustration where the biggest thing they've ever done, which is try to regime change the Iranian government, and it hasn't worked. That's the biggest thing they've ever done. They staked everything on that. And you should just know that at this point, now that that's not working out, they will not be mad at themselves. They're going to be mad at you for not liking it or appreciating it or for talking about it at all. Or for holding on to your outdated expectations about what life in this country was like then and should be now. And above all, for the insistence that you have as a voter and an American that the people in charge should serve you, not just themselves and their families. Your insistence that, wait a second, this Epstein thing, what is the Epstein thing? Shut up. By the way, it's just a few years ago that Harvard University took the name of Charles Glass off a building. Famous congressman, the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, half written by Congressman Glass. It took his name off a building. Why? Because he was a racist, and we have to get rid of all racists on the buildings at Harvard because we're making a moral statement. Harvard does not tolerate racism, even retroactively. If we find a racist with a name on a building at Harvard, we're taking it off. So pure are our motives. But guess whose name is still there? Not just on a building, but on the building at the entrance of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. At the entrance, the Lex Wexner building. Les Wexner. The guy who bankrolled Epstein? Whatever Epstein was accused of, Wexner probably helped pay for it. And his name is still on the building at Harvard. Now, why is that meaningful? Because it's a humiliation exercise. It's a really clear statement. Your ancestors were flawed, disgusting. We're taking their names off, tearing the monuments down. But Les Wexner, no. You may hate it. We don't care what you think. It's the Les Wexner building at Harvard. You getting the message now? It's a middle finger to you. That's hatred. You would think that just out of politeness, you would take Wexner's name off the building. You would think that, right? You would think just out of like a sense of duty that you might put some of the people who run Purdue Pharma in jail, at least for maybe one day, just symbolically. Your product killed tens of thousands of Americans and you knew it was doing it. You sold it anyway. No, not one person, not one day. You'd think like the heads of the big banks tanked the global economy, the global financial crisis. You think like one of them could go to jail for one day. Nope. Nope. It's your fault. You borrowed too much. So we have seen the outline of their contempt for a long time. It's not just indifference, it's loathing. And it's aimed at the population. And now it's coming to a head because war is by definition crisis and it forces pre-existing trends to the surface. And you should be prepared for however this manifests, because it's definitely coming.
So there is the coolest movie we can imagine. It's a new film adaptation of George Orwell's amazing novel, Animal Farm. 1984 gets all the attention, but Animal Farm is better. It's coming to theaters May 1st. You probably remember that Animal Farm is not actually about animals. It's about human nature, the desire for authority, and how quickly people tend to fall in line and give up all of their God-given rights. The movie follows Lucky, a young pig whose curiosity and courage guide viewers through the farm's rise and fall. We see hope, betrayal, and above all, the danger of totalitarian power. This is a movie to watch with your kids, especially if they're old enough to ask real questions and to notice when the answers don't add up. The book affected generations of American school kids, no longer taught, of course, because it's too true. What do you do when the rules start changing and you're told you're not allowed to notice? Do you speak up or you just go along with it because, hey, that's easier? That's the conversation you should have with your kids about power, corruption, and freedom. This movie's entertaining. It's sharp. Not many studios would do it at this point, but Angel did because their guild members voted to bring it to the big screen. So see it, talk about it, decide for yourself what it means. Animal Farm, theaters, May 1st. Tickets available now at angel.com/Tucker.
So is there a connection? Well, there obviously is. What exactly is the connection between neoconservative politics, the desire to regime change foreign powers, despite the total lack of benefit to the United States, and the desire to radically change the demographic mix of the United States, and the desire to, I don't know, lend money at high interest or let any of the festering social problems in this country go unaddressed? What is the connection? You really have to serve in the Congress to know. And Marjorie Taylor Greene did for 5 years from Georgia. Whether you agree with her or not, you'd have to say one of the most sincere people ever to serve in the Congress. So sincere that when she found out that all of it was fake, she left. We thought it'd be worth asking her, what is going on here? Ladies and gentlemen, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Congressman, thanks a lot for joining us. So you pretty recently served in the U.S. House, so maybe you can answer this question. Why is it that so many of the members of Congress who support this war, who supported the Iraq war, who support every pointless, counterproductive foreign entanglement, are also the very same people who were trying to force Americans to take the COVID shot, who voted to put spyware in people's cars, who are for the castration of children, who ignore the opioid crisis, and who are for mass migration? Why would neocon politics bring you to a place where you support all of these other things that are not connected to foreign policy, but that are also bad for the population of this country? Like, what's the connector?
Well, the obvious first response, any person with common sense would say, I have no idea why they would ever right. do that, right?
Fair.
And, yeah, and fair. Then secondly, I think the question is, why do Americans keep voting for these people? And yes. I think their responsibility falls on the voters to get rid of them. But I'll tell you why they keep voting for those things, Tucker. Having served in Congress for 5 years, what I learned from the inside is there are very powerful industries and their lobby, they're very powerful lobbyists, and the financial donations and structures that are built behind them is what entangles these politicians into supporting things that are unimaginable, things that Americans do not vote for. Like you said, gender affirming care, transing children, requiring cars to have AI big tech technology in them where they won't start if the AI deems that you're not capable of driving. The list goes on and on. Voting for FISA 702. Without warrants, warrantless spying on Americans. That's actually happening. I think they're having a vote right now on the House floor on the rule to move forward to do that. You can't answer. It doesn't make sense why they support these things, but I can tell you that it has a lot to do with the power structure in Washington, D.C., and it supports both Republicans and Democrats.
Because I think it's such a good point to make, because it's not ideological, at least in a way that people my age can understand. There's nothing conservative about
allowing the government to spy on you. There's nothing liberal about it in a traditional sense either. These are not liberal, conservative, left, right, even Republican, Democrat divides. Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a group that's for authoritarian policies that hurt Americans. And that's kind of what connects all of these positions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're bought and paid for. They do not represent the American people or the American people's interest. And it's because they're funded that way. For example, oh my gosh, this was shocking to me. Just last week, right? 57 Republicans voted no on an amendment to stop the government from controlling your car. Like that, what we're talking about, the AI capability. This was something yes. that Biden and the Democrats, they passed a law when I was serving in Congress. Of course, I voted no to it. And the law is to require every new car starting in 2027 to have technology in there to be able to basically scan you and determine if you're drunk, if you're capable, if you're healthy and fit and capable of driving your automobile. And the car will not start if AI determines that you're not. Now, 57 Republicans voted no on an amendment to stop that from happening. And I was shocked. It's your usuals, you know, Mike Lawler, Don Bacon, Randy Fine. But I was really surprised to see a name on the list, a recently elected Republican, Brian Jack from Georgia, who campaigned as being a conservative. I know his district really well. It was just to the south of my old district. These people don't support that, but yet his name was on there. And the question is, how did he fall into that trap? And why in the world would he vote no on an amendment to stop the government from basically controlling your vehicle? But this is, they get pulled in, and it all happens through fundraising. And it's the most unreal thing I've ever seen in my life.
So back to that, and the only thing I would quibble with in your description is the term "your vehicle." If the government can turn it off, it's not your vehicle anymore.
That's
they,
right.
They just took your vehicle from you. It's not yours. You don't have control over it, despite the fact you pay for it and keep up with the insurance and the maintenance. But to this question of the member from your delegation, the Georgia delegation, who just got elected as a, quote, conservative, mm-hmm. presumably for civil liberties and freedom and the Constitution, mm-hmm. like, how specifically do you think someone like that could wind up casting a vote this obviously authoritarian, this mm-hmm. obviously in contradiction to his own stated values? Like, what was the process that got him there, do you imagine?
Climbing the leadership ladder. Wanting to basically be the chairman of the NRCC, wanting to be fully integrated and in charge of all fundraising for the House GOP. That's probably what pulled him in. Brian Jack, who I actually campaigned for, I endorsed him because I believed he would be America first. So I was really shocked to see his name on this list. Actually really disgusted with it. I'm very unhappy that his name is on this list. Makes me regret endorsing him.
I bet.
Yeah, for sure. But his history is he was in on the political side for the president in the first administration, which means he worked with all the candidates and all the donors. Then he was on the he worked on the political operation for former Speaker Kevin McCarthy when he was the minority leader and then became Speaker of the House. So he's very donor driven, big donor driven, Washington, D.C. donors, donors that require government contracts, donors that are going to basically keep the big industries propped up and going. And so that's what would pull a Republican that campaigned on being America first, campaigned on being MAGA, campaigned on, you know, being a conservative. It's the donor driven money that happens behind the scenes that pulls a Republican over to that side. And when I say Republican driven, it's power. It's sheer power. In Washington, D.C., a member of Congress can fully fill their campaign coffers with just a few fundraisers in Washington, D.C., where you have the industry giants there, say whether it's the military industrial complex, the base there, those companies. Whether it's pharmaceutical companies, big tech companies, You name it, any industry that is trying to get this candidate to support the things that they desperately need to empower them, empower their companies, help their companies become richer and richer and richer and dominate in their industry. These executives will show up with their wives, and they'll have 10 to 20, maybe 30 of them there. And they're writing max checks on behalf of themselves, max checks on behalf of their wives. And they will be there supporting this, Republican member of Congress that needs to get reelected. And they can make hundreds of thousands of dollars, up to $1 million like that on just a few of those fundraisers. And so these Republicans that are flying back and forth to Washington, D.C. every week, they're away from their family, they're away from their friends, they're away from the people that elected them, which makes them forget what's important. They get really lazy, and it gets easy to just have a couple of fundraisers where you're getting drunk on cocktails and eating little weenies on a stick or whatever they're serving up there in the Capitol Hill Club. And this is how they'll make all that money. And it's a lot easier than having to go back to your district, face your district, have personal meetings with the donors and the good people that live in your district. It's a lot easier just to depend on those little fundraisers and hang around with the lobbyists and the people in Washington that you're seeing every single week than it is to go back home and say, hey, you guys, I got to get reelected. Can you support my campaign? I'd appreciate pitching in $50 or $100, or if you're capable, a max donation would be great. You know, I've got to get reelected to keep representing you. And so that's how they some of the ones that have good intentions, that's how they fall into it. But Tucker, there's a whole other side. There are Republican members of Congress that never had good intentions, ever.
Yeah.
Ever. And yeah. They came into the House of Representatives already completely supported and propped up and funded by this nasty entanglement I'm talking about in Washington. And I watched it with my own eyes when I watched Mike Lawler get elected.
Cost of living is already making it hard to live here, and it's not getting any better. Unfortunately, it's likely to get worse, and a lot of Americans fill the gap with credit cards, not just for fancy dinners, but to cover things like groceries and bills. That is a disaster. It's understandable, but don't go down that road, because there is a tax, in effect a survival tax, of 20% interest or more. Why would you do that? Why would you hand money to the big banks when you could keep it for your family? Our friends at American Financing have a better way. If you're looking to buy your first home or refinance your current one, they're helping Americans achieve the dream of homeownership with monthly mortgage rates currently in the fives. American Financing saves its customers an average of $800 per month. That's nearly 10 grand every year back to you. This isn't just a loan, it's a total financial reset. So debt is tough, but there's a smart way to do it and a reckless, self-destructive way to do it, credit cards. And so we recommend American Financing. They're salary-based, not commission-based, which means they actually work for you, not the banks. They're called America's Home for Home Loans for a reason. Call 800-685-5696, 800-685-5696, or visit AmericanFinancing.net/Tucker.
So Mike Lawler is, and Don Bacon is another name you mentioned a minute ago, but is kind of a metaphor for the corruption in the system, it would seem to me. So Mike Lawler obviously is way out there on pointless wars, neocon politics, loyalty to Israel, almost to a cartoonish point.
Yeah.
But he's also leading the charge on every other anti-human initiative that comes out of the United States Congress. Anything that's bad for the public, he's for. Anything that might help the public, he ignores. Like, what is that? What is his motive? Do you understand?
I'll go back to when he was a candidate for Congress. I was already serving in the House. And in our conference meetings, in our GOP conference meetings, the ones that we have at the Capitol Hill, we have two different type of conference meetings. Each week, there's one meeting a week, and it's kind of sad that your Republican representatives only meet one time a week, but once a week, and one is either political, and that one happens inside the Capitol, and then there's another kind that's completely and totally campaign and fundraising related. That one happens off campus at the Capitol Hill Club. And they bring in candidates. They'll bring in, you know, any new candidate running for Congress that, of course, is only approved by the NRCC and approved by the traditional establishment Republican Party in Washington. So they will bring in these candidates into this GOP meeting. They'll have them stand up, raise their hand, introduce themselves. The speaker or the leader, whoever is talking, will praise them and explain to everyone in the room why they've got to write them a max check immediately and help get them elected because they're fighting to become part of the team. So I remember specifically when Mike Lawler came in and he was welcomed in by everybody. I mean, he was propped up as the guy we have to fight for, one of the most critical races as an incoming Republican candidate, because it was a very close district. And it was so important. We were told it was so important to win this district. Well, I learned a lot about him very quickly. He, as a Catholic, Mike Lawler is a Catholic, was heavily supported and funded by the Jewish community there, and was heavily being supported by all the Christian Zionists. And he instantly had more support from pretty much every fundraising mechanism that there is in Washington, D.C. that supports Republicans. He had more help than I could have ever dreamed of having ever in my entire political career. And I was like, wow, what is going on with this guy? And it turns out he did win his race. It was a narrow victory, but he did win it. And of course, he instantly came into the House of Representatives completely bought and paid for by all of the establishment donor class that had supported him. He hated Donald Trump, made fun of him constantly, mimicked him, making fun of his voice. He used to attack me, make fun of me, come and find me on the House floor and make fun of me for supporting Donald Trump. And this was in the 4 years before Trump got elected as president again in 2024. And I was just like, this guy's like literally one of the worst. Well, I would say he's the worst, but Randy Fine is really the worst. But Mike Lawler was unbelievably, I thought he was a Democrat. I was like, he's literally a Democrat. He's so against all the things that Republican voters care about. And he clearly hates Donald Trump. Well, I saw this unbelievable change in him. And of course, it happened after Trump won his primary in 2024. All of a sudden, Mike Lawler, I started joking. I started calling him MAGA Mike Lawler because he was all of a sudden like becoming Trump's biggest supporter. And he was all excited. He got a MAGA hat signed by Donald Trump, came straight up to me to show it to me. And I'll never forget the day that he had gone and met with the president at the White House. Of course, I was not invited. Only this new, all the Republicans that hated the president before. Let me tell you, Tucker, it all changed. When Trump went in the White House, literally in a matter of months, those of us that fought for him when no one else would, who were basically like the inner circle, we all of a sudden got kicked out. And it was the Republicans like Mike Lawler and all these other guys that were the ones being constantly ushered into the White House for meetings and all kinds of things. So he came back on the House floor one day and he had one of Trump's gigantic challenge coins that's like big and gold and obnoxious and heavy. And he came up and he was like, I've got one of these, Marjorie. Do you have one of these? And he was all bragging about it. But you know what that told me, Tucker, is what I really reflecting on it now that I didn't really realize at that time was that the president, not only was Mike Lawler fully bought and paid for by this and Don Bacon and all these other guys, fully bought and paid for by the political industrial complex that maintains the power structure in Washington that is completely America last. But the fact that they were the ones now first on the list to go to the White House and the ones being courted all the time, that meant that's when the president also became bought and paid for by the exact same group of people, powerful donor class, and the powerful industries.
So the reason Mike Lawler was unusual, even in the Congress, was he was such a slavish servant of Israel. Mm-hmm. From his very first public statements, everything was about Israel. He comes from a district with a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. I didn't read a single solution to any of those problems he was proposing, but it was always about Israel. Would you say that the group that hated Trump and then early in the term got invitations to the White House, were they all servants of Israel?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Are you kidding me? Tucker, when I introduced an amendment to defund Israel just last year, it hasn't even been a year yet. Only five other members of Congress, five out of 435, only five voted with me to defund American taxpayer dollars going to Israel. So that's your count. If you want to know how many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are completely beholden to funding Israel, no matter what they do, no matter how much genocide they commit, no matter how many Lebanon Christian villages they destroy, no matter which country they decide to bomb out of their madness and desire for destruction, it was only five. It's total six of us. There were six of us, including myself. That's your count.
I assume Massey was one of those.
Of course, Thomas Massey was one. Of course.
Yeah.
He's not bought and paid for, which is why his race is the most important race that has to be won. None of the other ones really matter.
I don't want to get too sidetracked, but since you mentioned his race, where is that race now?
It is tightened. He's still in the lead, but it's definitely tightened. I've seen different polling. It's got him anywhere of approximately 5 to 7 points ahead of this guy named Ed Gallran, who, by the way, Ed Gallran won't even show up to debate Thomas Massey. Like, that's one of, it's like campaign 101. If you're running for Congress, you should be able to show up to a debate in your district in front of the people that you're wanting to vote for you. And you should be able to show up in person and stand in front of a microphone and a camera against your opponent and address why you will be a better representative than the current representative, Thomas Massey. And Ed Gallran has not shown up to a single one. As far as my knowledge, he hasn't shown up at all. And by the way, he's completely funded by three Zionist billionaires, 100% funded, that have given tens of millions of dollars, and they don't even live in his district. They couldn't relate to Kentucky. That they only know about Tel Aviv. It's the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen happen. And Chris LaCivita is the guy that's running the race because he, of course, Chris LaCivita, who does he work for? Lindsey Graham, John Cornyn, some of the worst Republicans. And he's doing everything he can, aligning himself with these three Zionist billionaires to defeat Thomas Massey.
What, why, and who is Chris, for people who don't follow this stuff, who is Chris LaCivita?
Chris LaCivita is a big fat political consultant that is richer beyond his wildest dreams and beyond your wildest dreams because he sucks in donor money so that he can put TV ads and mail. So he can run campaigns basically that elect the very people that you hate. You absolutely hate the candidates that he supports, like Lindsey Graham, like Ed Gallran. He supports the candidates that are completely funded and controlled by the very political Washington political establishment that we're talking about, that owns Mike Lawler, that owns Don Bacon, that owns Maria Salazar, Carlos Jimenez, Mario Diaz-Balart. The list goes on and on. I guess apparently just bought Brian Jack with his vote to take away control of your car that you pay for. But that is exactly who Chris LaCivita works for. Chris LaCivita also works for President Trump. Chris LaCivita used to hate President Trump, but he wiggled himself in there, just slimed his way in. And now he's frequently at the White House practically every single day. He ran the president's 2024 campaign alongside Susie Wiles. And he is the guy that's trying to beat Thomas Massey. Yep.
So it does seem like, just from an outside perspective, it seems like the more you exhibit loyalty to Israel, the closer you are to the White House political operation.
100%. You, well, Tucker, I'm no longer in Congress because I did not bow in obedience to AIPAC and to the Zionists that control Washington, literally fully control Washington, D.C. I wouldn't take any of their money. I voted to defund American tax dollars going to Israel. I voted to release the Epstein files, which is linked to Israel. And so, yeah, you have a hard time existing or fighting for your political career if you aren't part of that.
As a gun owner, you know the dilemma. You want to be prepared for break-ins or any moment where you might need a firearm, but you also need to keep those firearms secure, out of the hands of kids, for example. So for years, that meant choosing between a gun safe that takes a long time to open, pretty impossible in an emergency, or leaving something accessible but unsafe, and neither option is a good option. And that's why we are thrilled to partner with Stopbox. We're not exaggerating when we say that using Stopbox changes everything. Here's what makes it different. The Stopbox Pro is completely mechanical. No keys, no batteries. It does not fail. It's got 5 buttons designed for muscle memory. This is one that we keep here in the studio. You program your own code, practice it a couple of times, and your fingers remember it. And that means you get immediate access to your firearm when you need it, and everyone else can't get it. And here's something else. It is TSA compliant. You can check your firearm safely and legally when you fly. No drama at the airport. Plus, it's made in the United States. No tariffs. Real American jobs and quality you can trust and that we do trust. Stopbox offers a range of products designed to make for an array of needs. Take the new Stopbox UCAN, which uses the same mechanical system as the Pro, but has a much bigger storage capacity. Room for guns, ammo, targets, everything you want. For a limited time, our listeners get 10% off using the code Tucker at checkout. Visit StopboxUSA.com. Use the code Tucker for 10% off your whole order. Now, if you purchase, feel free to mention that you heard about it right here on the show. So my understanding of Trump, and I talked to him a lot, as you have, was that, you know, Trump supported Israel in the same sense that I always supported Israel. You always support Israel. Like, yeah, Israel, it's great. You know, not against mm-hmm. Israel. It's not the thing I think about all day. Not Josh Hammer or anything, but like, I'm not against it. And right. Trump seemed to have a kind of, I don't know, sensible view of Israel. And then at a certain point in the last year and a half, everything became about Israel. And that was the measure that Trump and his political team used to decide who is an ally and who's an enemy. When did that change? Am I imagining this? I mean, that's my perception of it anyway. Tell me yours.
I agree with you. It did change. And just to be clear, we're talking about the secular government of Israel and the
talking about the government of Israel, exactly.
And the donors that fully fund it, not only fund anything that supports the secular government of Israel, but they also do anything that funds the IDF and the wars that they fight. So to be clear, that's what we're talking about. Of course, we're not talking about Jewish people. This isn't about anti-Semitism, but he did change over time. And I'll be really clear. This is something that is my own conclusion. To become president of the United States, there's deals that have to be made. Otherwise, you aren't allowed to have that power. And you can go president by president throughout time, and especially throughout our lifetimes, and you can look at every single president and look at their career and the decisions that they made, and you can very quickly see that they made their deal to support Israel at all times. Why does the United States of America do that for one foreign country? It makes absolutely no sense. We don't do that for any other foreign country. No other government on earth does every single United States president, the vast majority of members of Congress, completely pledge their allegiance. Governors too, we have to include governors and state elected officials. They pledge their complete allegiance to the government of Israel and their purpose and their protection. And whatever endeavor they decide to pursue, whether it's right or wrong, whether it helps America or even if it hurts America, they still pledge their full allegiance. They make that deal. And Tucker, I don't care what anybody thinks about me, but I believe that Trump had to make a deal like this in order to become president. And That's why people see the drastic change in him. Now, he was beholden to a lot of the establishment Washington industries and their donors in his first administration. That happened. And we can look at COVID and hit the response. Shutting down the entire country to slow the spread of a virus was absolutely serving that gigantic machine. It wasn't for the American people. That did not help Americans. It did not help American small business owners. It hurt us. It hurt children's education. I mean, that's a whole nother subject. But he did that. Trump did that in his first term. However, this term, we've watched him drastically change literally from the first quarter of his presidency to being completely basically held captive in servitude to whatever Bibi Netanyahu demands of him. That's fighting wars. That's creating policy that benefits Israel. And that is even to the point of defeating a House Republican that votes with him over 90% of the time, defeating Thomas Massey because those giant billionaire Israel donors say it has to happen. And I don't know how and why, and I don't know how you change that. And I don't know how this came to be, but I think it happened over decades. And it's a much bigger problem than people realize. It's not anti-Semitic for us to talk about it. It doesn't mean that we're against Jewish people, not at all. We love all people. We're Christians. We're commanded to love all people. But our government, the United States of America, should be serving the American people and the American people's interest first and foremost at all times, 100%, and should not be easily dragged off into bombing Iran or paying to fund all types of military equipment and weapons to perform genocide on Gaza or Christians in Lebanon and villages in Lebanon and taking their land. The hypocrisy of it is beyond, it's unspeakable. The King of England, King Charles, spoke to Congress this week and literally demanded that the United States of America go to war with Russia because Russia invaded Ukraine, which is absurd. Yet no one is demanding the United States stop supporting Israel as they have literally and are at this moment doing the same thing to Lebanon. And it's not anti-Semitic to say, why is that happening? This shouldn't be happening. Why the hypocrisy? Masses about and members of Congress stood up and applauded King Charles when he demanded that. And I myself watched that and I said, well, I know for a fact, because I've been there, I know the things said in speeches to Congress publicly, because that's what that foreign leader is asking of Congress. Those same conversations happen privately at the White House. And it would be really naive for anyone to think that King Charles is not talking to Donald Trump about going to war with Russia because of the Ukraine-Russia war. And that concerns me.
It's just interesting that you think of donors to the Republican Party and Democratic Party, I should say, who are pretty single-mindedly focused on the fortunes of Israel, and they want foreign aid, they want a defense guarantee, they want the United States military to protect Israel as it continues its expansion in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all true. But that same set of donors, and this is the part that does confuse me, is also the group that forced the Biden administration to fund the Ukraine war, that has prevented this administration from ending or really even working to end the Ukraine war. This is also the very same group that has pushed open borders and has convinced the president to change his longstanding and often stated view on immigration. So he got elected in 2016, promising to build a wall, didn't build a wall, didn't really try very hard to build a wall. And now is saying, well, actually, I'm not going to deport a lot of people. We're going to make them citizens.
Yep.
We're going to start the process of, you know, immigration reform, or whatever phrase they're using. But Trump is now pro-immigration, which is an amazing change, once again, at the behest of these donors. These are the same people who have pushed open borders in Europe, who've abetted the refugee migration from Syria and Africa into Western Europe and then complained about it. Why is that? Like, why would people who support Israel also be for changing the demographic mix of the United States? That doesn't make sense.
Well, it's true. It is true. And it's happened for many years now. Our demographics have been drastically changing. That happens through our border, through open border policies of administrations and administrations that refuse to enforce our laws. We have laws. People can be deported. It's just the fact that they haven't fully supported them and enforced those laws. So there's absolutely no reason, for example, for approximately 10 or 11 Republicans to vote with the Democrats to pass a bill. This happened just this month, to extend the temporary protection status of 350,000 Haitians. Now, you have to ask yourself, like, I think people that watch Fox News all day will go, oh, those typical bad old rhinos, and they'll be mad and go, why did they do that? But what really happens behind the scenes is these powerful lobbies and these powerful groups who are basically businesses that run off of government contracts, they run off of grants they receive, they run off the, you can call open borders an industry. It is a huge, powerful industry. It's an industry of all types of charities and nonprofits and NGOs that are everything from people that give someone that comes across the border a backpack, or say like Haitians that have to be protected here in America and are allowed to live here and work for free, even though they're not citizens, but they're protected. This is an entire industry. It's people that serve all of that in every capacity, even lawyers, American lawyers that help these people through the so-called immigration process, or really to stay in America against our laws. Now, why is that happening? I think the answer is really dark. It weakens our country. Anytime you change the demographics of a country, you drastically change the people there, which radically changes the views of the people, because you have such a vast variety of all types of people with all types of belief systems and all types of opinions. Now, when you fill a country with millions of people that are dependent on the government because the government let them in, they weren't born here, they came across the border and then they may have been protected like Dreamers, like Obama protected the Dreamers, or you say the Haitians, 350,000 of them that, I couldn't believe it, Rich McCormick, another Republican member of Congress who is from my state, who I personally know, voted to protect 350,000 Haitians. It doesn't make sense. Like, why would he do that? But they do it to weaken our country, because when you weaken the country, you weaken the people, and you weaken the voting, basically the votes, because eventually these people get status and eventually they become voters as well. Then you change the trajectory of the country, and you also change the focus of the government. So let's take, there's members of Congress that have dual citizenships. They are there for the interest of the country they came from. They are there serving a foreign group of people that is in their district, and they are beholden to them. And that means that they are not voting for who would be original American citizens, which I think is a problem. It's very hard to change, but I don't know how we got here, Tucker.
It's obviously very deep, whatever's happening, because mm-hmm. it doesn't on the surface make any sense. So here you have people like Mike Lawler, or mm-hmm. Don Bacon, and there are a bunch of them, mm-hmm. as you know,
yeah,
who are wholly focused on preserving the state of Israel as an ethno state,
yep.
as a state in which citizenship is really determined by your ethnicity. Okay, I'm kind of agnostic on that. It's not my country. Mm-hmm. But they're very focused on that. Israel has a right to exist as an ethno state. And at the same time, their greatest fear in the United States is that the U.S. will be an ethno state. And so we need to prevent that by changing the demographic mix.
Right.
that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, that just doesn't tell me what that adds up to. But it's very obvious as you watch that those are their twin priorities. Preserve Israel as an ethnostate, prevent the United States from being an ethnostate. What are we watching?
I don't know. I just looked at the list of the Republicans that voted to protect Haitians. And so it's pretty interesting to me. Fitzpatrick, Lawler, Bacon, Maria Salazar, Carlos Jimenez, Nicole Malliotakis, Rich McCormick, Mike Turner, who's not running for Congress again, Mike Carey, and Mario Diaz-Balart. There's several names on there, Salazar, Jimenez, Diaz-Balart, that fight the hardest for anyone that's come across the border. I mean, they literally want to just make them citizens, give it to them for free. Maria Salazar
for sure
has a bill that she's trying to do that. But ironically, that same group, the same group that I just read, is also completely, and you can add, we need to add more in there. I think the bigger list is the 57 Republicans that voted no on stopping the government from controlling your car. I think that's the more expanded list. You could expand it even bigger than that. Those are the Republicans that will vote for Israel to have anything and everything. Like, they fully agree with Lindsey Graham when he's melting down on television about we have to give money to Israel. When Levin is demanding that we use nuclear bombs on Iran, many of these same House Republicans would support that. I don't know what that is, Tucker, and I don't know why it's that way. I think there's been a brainwashing that's happened in this country, and it's happened a lot through evangelical churches. It's happened a lot through just a lot of churches, honestly. And the message has been told to the American people over and over and over and over again that we have to support Israel at all costs, at all times, no matter what. And there's, you know, tragic events that have helped shape many Americans' views to support that, such as 9/11 and such as other horrific terrorist incidences here in America, but also what we've been fed on the television of suicide bombers in Israel and so forth. They don't ever show the other side of what happened, but they show that nonstop. Now, so that has hardened many Americans to believe that America has to support Israel at all costs, no matter what. They use the verse in Genesis, use that against Americans, Christian or not, to believe that if you don't bless Israel, then you're going to be cursed by God. And that's absolutely not true. And you've talked about that a lot, thankfully, as well as others did. But it has been basically propaganda and messaging that has been told to Americans for so long. And the baby boomers, who we love, that's our parents' generation, and not all of them. There's some really good baby boomers, but the baby boomer generation as a whole are the ones that have embraced it the most on Republican and the Democrat side. Both sides fully supporting Israel. Give them all your money. You know, the best way we can help our grandchildren's future, they may be broke and can't have a job and can't afford health insurance and can't afford to do anything in life. And AI will totally replace their future jobs. But you know what? We got to stop Iran from having a nuclear weapon. And it's been that propaganda that has not only basically wrangled in these members of Congress and other elected officials that are fully supported by that lobby and the massive donor list that comes with it. It's huge. You have no idea how big it is. Jews and Christians. It's the AIPAC umbrella, but it's much bigger than AIPAC itself. Lots of donors that, hey, will write you a check and say, you just make sure that you take care of Israel. And so they are wrapped in and beholden by that money. And it's supported by Americans who have been brainwashed to believe that that's exactly what America has to do. But nobody ever talks about, Tucker, nobody ever talks about the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons. Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. Like, who's really going to mess with Israel at the end of the day? They have nuclear weapons. It's just like, do you ever see anybody freaking out about Kim Jong-un anymore in North Korea?
No.
No, because he has nuclear weapons. So what a lie it is that we really have to support Israel.
I have for years noticed that there are people who truly love Israel. It's never bothered me. People love, I don't know, model trains or kite surfing or what. People love a lot of things. I don't feel threatened by it. You're allowed to love whatever you want, as far as I'm concerned. In the case of loving Israel, however, for American leaders, some Jewish, mostly not Jewish, it's the same principle. It seems like that love for Israel is accompanied by contempt for the United States, maybe even hatred for the United States. What is it? Maybe it's impossible to serve two masters. Maybe you will always wind up hating one of them. Maybe that's a biblical principle. Maybe that's true. I really don't know the answer. But among that group that we're talking about and that you served with, did you ever have conversations offline where they said, you know, we've got to do something about, I don't know, health insurance prices or opioid ODs or, I don't know, the elimination of our kids' employment future by AI or any of the truly pressing, in fact, ominous problems this country faces. Did they ever talk about that stuff in private?
Most Republicans, if they had a bill they were trying to get me to co-sponsor, it's such a circus on the House floor. So when we're at votes and we're spending a lot of time on the House floor and you're in there and it's everybody in there together, Republicans and Democrats, and everyone's sitting in the brown leather chairs that I don't know how old those chairs are. And we're voting with our little voting cards and the little machine with the green yes and the red no and the yellow present. You're sitting there and there's a lot of commingling going on. You know, a lot of that's where, if you're not in a meeting once a week, that's kind of where you see everybody. So different Republicans and members will go around with a card and they're asking for people to co-sponsor their bill that may be supporting, it's usually something that helps the medical industry or the pharmaceutical industry, or it's maybe something very district specific. Sometimes that will be something they're working on. But did I ever see anybody going around like really fighting hard to focus on direct American issues? No, a lot of times not. And a lot of times it was, hey, we're going to have a resolution this week denouncing anti-Semitism because there were protests on college campuses, because college kids were saying there was genocide in Gaza. You know, they would be asking for support to get some bill passed through that would provide funding for some big company that is in their district or has been lobbying Washington, because whatever provision is in the next defense budget will really help them. Ridiculous things like that. No, Tucker, it wasn't. It's something interesting. I came across this one too. I wanted to tell you. Here's how America last. It has been. It really is. So they renamed, remember Trump came in and they renamed the Department of Defense to the Department of War. That has cost, the Pentagon has estimated that it's cost approximately $52 million just to rename the Department of Defense to the Department of War. That's the kind of stuff that a lot of Republicans will come around and say, hey, we gotta get behind the team and get this done. But do they ever come in? And I had a hard time. I had a bill and it passed, Protect Children's Innocence Act. It was the one bill that I pushed so hard with everyone. And Protect Children's Innocence Act makes it a felony to perform transgender surgeries and hormone blockers and all kinds of drugs on children. It's not adults. It's not some sick man that wants to get a boob job. We're talking about kids. And I constantly would go around and ask for their support. Well, I have to tell this story because it just has to be told. My last vote in Congress, literally my last vote on the House floor, December 17th, was my own bill. It finally, I had to fight with everybody to get that bill to the floor. I mean, I threatened, I withheld votes on funding. I fought them all and it finally got there. And to my complete shock, four Republicans voted no. Four. And that was Brian Fitzpatrick, Mike Lawler, Mike Kennedy, and Gabe Evans. So Mike Lawler voted no to my bill because he wants kids to, he wants your kids to be trans, basically. It's totally fine with him if your child goes to a school where a teacher indoctrinates them. It's totally fine with him if they get indoctrinated on the internet and they get brainwashed and confused and maybe live in California or some other blue state where they can go to a doctor and basically a teenage girl could end up getting a mastectomy. Mike Lawler is totally fine with that. He voted no. My bill simply made it a felony to do that to children. He voted no to that, and so did three other Republicans. The craziest thing happened, Tucker. This was the miracle I witnessed, because God performs miracles. And this is why I believe, even though nothing makes sense right now, I believe in my heart, I have full faith in God, that God can change it if we are willing to fight for it. My bill passed. My bill passed that in the House because God moved three Democrats to vote for it. Four Republicans voted against it, even though the entire Republican Party campaigned on stopping the trans agenda on children, and it was supported by 70% of Americans. When God knew those four Republicans were voting no, God moved three Democrats to vote for it, and my bill passed the House floor. Protect Children's Innocence Act was also sponsored by our great Vice President, J.D. Vance, when he was a senator. He was the original sponsor of that bill in the Senate. He is now the leader of the Senate. So I can tell you that right now, Republicans have the full capability of passing that bill in the Senate, and President Trump would sign it into law because it's a direct reflection on his own executive order. And soon, the leader in the Senate has my bill, Protect Children's Innocence Act, that makes it a felony to trans a kid, is sitting on a shelf in the Senate. And our vice president hasn't gone in there and fought with him to, hey, let's get this to the floor for a vote. Let's whip our senators, because this was a campaign promise in 2024. You see, when people refuse, when good men refuse to do, when they do nothing, that's when evil prevails. And that is literally where we are. We are at a point in history where all types of evil is prevailing. Nothing makes sense. Those that are the worst people are the most powerful people right now. Those that are committing crimes and corruption are making all the money right now. And it's because we have a completely feckless Republican Party that is 100% owned and sold out to a foreign country and a foreign country's lobby and a foreign country's donors. And that is why everything insane is happening. That's why nothing makes sense.
It would be interesting to know why it's so important to Paul Singer that we continue to neuter children. I don't know the answer. It clearly is so important that he and donors like him are preventing this from being banned. I mean, it's insane. Okay, so you painted a pretty grim, very grim picture of the state of Washington right now and how far the concerns of lawmakers and the executive are from voters. It doesn't feel like this can continue indefinitely because it's too screwed up. And it feels like it's radicalizing people in a way that's scary. So what is the solution? Where does it go from the midterms this fall to 2028? What happens that makes this system more representative, slightly more representative of the public, do you think?
Well, I think that's a great question, and we can break it down. I was told, reliably told by one of the most well-known pollsters in Washington, D.C., that Republicans are expecting to lose anywhere between 20 and 40 seats in the House. And I say rightfully so. They deserve it. They 100% deserve
it. They definitely deserve it. Does the public deserve it? I don't know. But
the party
definitely deserves it. Yeah, for sure.
So let's look at the current situation. The Democrats completely destroyed so many things. And America basically gave them a very strong message in November of 2024 that they refused to support wokeness, DEI, the Green New Deal, the trans agenda. They found all of that disgusting. The American people were sick of censorship. So many people had been kicked off social media because the Biden administration had pushed that. The American people, one of their loudest messages was no more foreign wars. It was so simple. So let's look at what the current system we have. The failures of the Democrat and Republican Party is why people like me supported Donald Trump. Total and utter failures of both parties. They're both disgusting and repulsive. They function as one weird uniparty in so many ways, but at the same time, the things both parties represent through their actions, I'm not saying what they say on the campaign trail, through their actual actions, their vote, the legislation, and the things they fund are disgusting. And they don't represent America at all, either party. It shocked me that Democrats, after losing so badly in 2024, that their entire party didn't go into a room and really have a serious talk amongst themselves and go, we've got to change our ways. We've got to change some of our serious policies. We need to, you know, things they need to back off of. They should have learned their lesson on their failures, but they didn't. They changed nothing. And so now they're expecting to win the midterms basically on Trump derangement syndrome, which is the same thing that they have been campaigning on for years. They're also planning to win the midterms based on the pathetic, utter failures of the Republican Party, but because the Republican Party is just as gross and disgusting as the Democrat Party. Look at the Republican Party. They learned nothing, Tucker. We gave them the strongest message that can be sent. It was a mandate in 2024. The mandate was no more foreign wars and put Americans first. And the Republican Party did nothing. What they did is they came in and they used the same system that swings like a pendulum back and forth between whoever's in charge. And they brought that big, powerful lobby and their donors and their industries. And they basically swallowed Donald Trump whole and made sure that he was completely owned and controlled by the government of Israel and whatever war they want to fight. So where does that leave us going forward? My hopes is when I resigned from Congress, I wanted the American people to understand something, that me leaving doesn't leave them in any worse position. They are already in the worst position. Me leaving doesn't mean that no one's there fighting for them. It means that even when I was there fighting as hard as I possibly could, I could stop nothing. But it's really up to the American people to change it. Now, here's where the American people have a job to do. It's the American people that keep reelecting the Lindsey Grahams and the Mike Lawlers and all the disgusting people that most Republican voters say they hate, but yet somehow they keep voting for them. I think they should change that. Another thing is, look, I don't want Democrats to win because I don't support their policies either, but why am I afraid of Republicans losing? I'm not. I resigned from Congress because I refused to be a part of, and I refused to support a party that lied to the American people and is completely selling them out. And I think that's what American voters really need to take in. You know, there's a way to take back control, and it comes from forming a powerful alliance of Americans that will only support candidates that are small dollar campaigns. Candidates that absolutely refuse to take any money from AIPAC, from the military-industrial complex, big pharma, the big industries and the big donors, the big nasty donors, and the big nasty political consultants that continue the America Last policies that we all are living in and we hate. The American people can elect people that will represent them when those representatives are only funded by the people that vote for them. That's the only way to get there. It is the only way going forward, because whoever holds the purse strings holds the power over these elected officials.
So do you think that can be done within the current structure, or do you think this calls for a third party or a fourth party?
I think it has to be weighed. I've been looking at the numbers. Independents in America are bigger than the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. Independents are oftentimes over 40%. And if independents were to come together on a core group of policy issues and candidates that they could fully support, then you could defeat Democrat and Republican candidates. It's not, it would be very hard, but it is possible. I think it's largely dependent on several things, Tucker. It's the millennials, many of the millennials, and it's Gen Z. It's if the younger generations truly rise up and decide to get politically active, they could fully take over and take the power away from the baby boomer generation. The baby boomer generation is the generation that supports the current political industrial complex. They support it fully, Democrat and Republican. They're the ones that vote the most. They're the ones that donate the most. And they're the ones that remain glued to the television, to the propaganda news that they're fed every single day from the left and the right. However, I fully believe that it's the younger generations that can make the difference. And educating them, harnessing their power, and helping them understand that it's they who can take over and take control, then I think this country can be saved. And I'll say one more thing about the baby boomers. And I really attack the baby boomers a lot because I am angry about many of the things their generation has supported and done. I'm fully disgusted at baby boomers that hold on to power in Congress and in the Senate and many elected positions. Even our current president falls in that category. He'll probably never want to leave the White House, and I'm sure me saying that will make headlines. However, I think those baby boomers are the most dangerous, and they're completely responsible for our nearly $40 trillion in debt, the fact that Social Security will be completely insolvent in just 6 to 7 years, and the very fact that young Americans have it much harder because our dollar is so weak. Tragically, it may require the baby boomer generation passing away before Gen Z and even millennials can fully get involved and work hard to take it back. But I don't think it's impossible, because I'll go back and just finish with this. Like I told you, I witnessed a miracle on the House floor on my very last vote when my bill, Protect Children's Innocence, passed to make it a felony to trans children. 4 Republicans voted no, and 3 Democrats voted yes. And that passed that bill. And I never thought that bill was going to pass. Everyone told me it was impossible. Everybody, literally every single Republican told me, Marjorie, this bill will never pass. But it did, Tucker. And I believe it was truly God. I felt it. I know it in my heart. And I watched it happen. I was there. It literally was a miracle. So in saying that, I'll say this, Tucker. I believe good Americans, through no hate in their heart whatsoever, who have their full faith in God, they can actually take back this country. But you can't be complacent. You can't sit on the sidelines. And you truly, honestly, have to have courage to get involved.
Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And thank you. We'll see you next Wednesday.